This is Todd Zwillick back with you today on The Takeaway.
Any type of industry where an employee is dealing with a customer from the outside places them at risk.
500 people were killed at workplaces in 2016 in the United States. How employers balance worker safety with keeping their businesses accessible. Also, the trial of three men accused of plotting to attack Somali Muslims in Kansas and how the president's tweets are playing out in the courtroom.
A lot of these potential jurors were of this belief that the FBI was basically out to get Trump and out to get perhaps his supporters.
And 50 years ago today, violence erupted in cities around the country after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, but not in Boston.
I thought there was going to be some problems, but everybody was just nice to each other. Sat down on the train like a Sunday afternoon. Unbelievable.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, April 5th, 2018. Investigators in California are piecing together a motive for Nassim Aghdam's attack at the YouTube headquarters in San Bruno, California on Tuesday. The 39-year-old woman opened fire on employees having lunch outside before killing herself. Employees were stunned by the attack on their workplace campus. Almost as quickly as the gunfire started, employees started tweeting about the chaos. Now barricaded inside of a room with coworkers, read one tweet. Another read, "We hear people running because it was rumbling the floor." And one employee said he had experienced gun violence multiple times in the workplace over his career. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there were 500 workplace homicides in 2016. That's up from 409 just 2 years before. And that same agency estimates that 2 million Americans are victims of some form of workplace violence every year. So how safe do you feel in your workplace?
Working in a public performance venue, I've always been aware of the public's access to my workplace. Not to mention growing up in the era of 9/11, I try to stay aware of my surroundings and check the exits when outside of my home. Recent upticks in mass shootings and aggressive public behavior definitely has necessitated conversations at work about exit routes and safety plans. My name's Max, and I'm calling from Stoughton, Massachusetts.
Hi, this is Layla from Greenville, South Carolina. I work for the government in a social services capacity, and we have had bomb threats, threats of mass shootings, and violent irate clients. We have had glass windows added at interview stations to separate us from clients, but we still don't have metal detectors in, so I don't feel as safe as I should.
My name is Andy. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm a horticultural specialist. I travel to people's houses all over our city and area, and it would be almost impossible to secure any area that I work in. Although I handle myself pretty well, after over 30 years of this, my biggest injuries have come from hornets and dogs, hornets being the worst by far.
I work for an agritourism farm that sees dozens of thousands of guests per year. Every year, our supervisory team and our management team are trained on how to handle active shooter situations because we are what is considered a soft target. I always feel prepared in the event of an emergency, but at the same time, it fills me with a fear as well as some constant anxiety on busy days that something might happen. I'm suspicious of many people that visit, but also try to keep a very positive outlook that in the event that anything did happen, we would be prepared. My name is Maggie, and I am from Chester, New Jersey.
Maggie from New Jersey describing how her work at an agrotourism farm is considered a soft target in America. Lisa Pompei is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston, and she says that while workplace violence is common in this country, it's important to classify the shooting at YouTube this week as an extreme case.
Well, I think when a homicide occurs in the workplace, or an attempted homicide, especially with gun violence, that isn't typical. So when we talk about workplace violence, that's really at the end of the spectrum with regard to severity. So workplace violence can range from, you know, aggression, incivility, all the way up through physical assault and then homicide. You know, that was a very serious event that occurred, so I wouldn't say that that's typical.
If that was one of the extreme cases, and certainly it is extreme, what then explains the apparent rise in workplace homicides or attempted homicides? They seem to have gone up significantly in the last couple of years.
Well, it appears through the BLS that the numbers are higher. I can't necessarily comment on the rate if they're really significantly higher. I think that they have increased and there's more publicity and social media focus on those types of events. So it's hard to say what's increasing that overall. I think there's things that are specific to certain types of workplaces and industries that may foster the increase of that. But to say globally overall, I'm not sure I can give you an answer for that.
Well, let's talk about some of those workplaces and industries that may be more prone to workplace violence, either from employees within or ex-employees or people coming from the outside, which appears to have happened in this case. What are some of those industries that might stand out?
Well, any type of industry where an employee is dealing with a customer from the outside places them at risk. So workers that are in retail, taxi cab drivers, even individuals in healthcare, because they're providing a service to the public from the outside. So those individuals are coming from the outside that organization into the organization. And so, you know, that does increase they seem to be at greater risk for workplace violence.
The interface between people at the company or the business and the customer on the outside. In this case, at YouTube, people having their lunch at the office, some of them may have dealt with a customer like Ms. Ogdon, but not face-to-face because it's over the internet. It's a special case.
Right, exactly. But it's my understanding that that person was disgruntled with individuals in the organization, and so they know where those people work, and so that really is a risk of, let's say someone's being targeted. Well, it's easy to find them if you know where they work. You may not know where they live, or you may not know where they're traveling, but you do know where they work. And so this can even be a serious issue for domestic violence. So individuals who are being stalked or abused by a partner, the one common denominator is that you know where they work. And so that can place a work situation or an employer at risk, an institution at risk for individuals coming in from the outside that may not be customer service business, okay? If there's easy access into the building and there's no barriers, that person can just walk in and they know who they're targeting. And so, you know, a lot of times employers, that type of event is, it's so rare that it isn't part of the organization's infrastructure to, let's say, have physical barriers set up or restricted access into the building set up, because they aren't dealing with customers all day long. So it really is, it's a hard thing to prepare for unless it's really you make an overall change to your organization of having restricted access. But then you also have to have policies internally that workers have a method for stepping forward if they're afraid that someone from the outside is targeting them. Then the organization has to step in and help them and protect the rest of their workforce.
That could be a very difficult thing for an employee to bring to management at work, some form of disagreement or chaos in their personal life. They're not going to want to come to work and be seen as disruptive if they say, I have somebody in my personal life who might try to hurt me here.
You're correct. It's very hard to come forward. So they may not want to come forward because they may be afraid it'll compromise their job. It can also be embarrassing. It can also feel like it's something you don't want to tell, that they may think that it's a poor reflection on them, so they don't come forward. But also, I'm not sure that it is common practice for organizations to actually have something in place that allows their workers to come forward. And, you know, this is something that historically I've seen in the occupational health world that I live in, that sometimes employers have kind of, they've tried to put in mechanisms to have workers feel more comfortable about stepping forward, where they partner, let's say human resources partners with their employee assistance program and with employee health. So, you know, a lot of organizations, they'll conduct an annual physical or health check on their workers. That may be an optimal time to ask workers in privacy, confidentially, you know, is everything okay at home? Or are you concerned? Or are you a victim of domestic violence? I mean, sometimes we have to screen for that and allow workers to have a place to come forward and also get the appropriate interventions and support.
It seems like a potentially complicated situation in a lot of businesses, Lisa Pompei. Businesses in general want to stay accessible and open to consumers. You don't want to have barriers for people to do business with you and spend money. And it's easy to imagine an employer even being sympathetic and sensitive to these issues, saying, I don't want to put up walls between my workers and customers.
Exactly. And so a great example of that is in healthcare. And when you walk into a hospital, they want it to look pleasing and presentable and comfortable for patients and their family members. And so there's a lot of things that are aesthetically pleasing. And then they forego, and I'm just speaking in general, some of the walkthroughs that I've done in hospitals, they forego some of the security measures that should be in place to protect workers because, you know, it provides people from the outside to come in and really have easy access into the worker area where workers may not have an area then to go to protect themselves if they have a patient or a family member that's violent.
So let's end on this particular case at YouTube in California and Nassim Agdam's attack and suicide there, Lisa Pompei. It's so hard to imagine workers on this campus eating their lunch, having any sense that their daily work on the back end of YouTube could lead to a violent attack like this. And we don't know the exact physical plant at this place next to the parking garage, but what on its face strikes you might have room for improvement there?
I think where there could be improvement is having that organization take a look at what their internal policies are on workplace violence prevention, if they even have a policy. Okay, what type of physical barriers and security measures do they have in place? You know, do they have a way to check individuals before they come in through the front door? But really also the other thing too for those workers, because this is such an unusual event, is what kind of infrastructure is already in place or should be in place to help workers once that happens? I'm sure that those workers are traumatized and the employer will really need to be able to step in and provide a great deal of emotional support going forward.
Lisa Pompei is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Professor, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
On Wednesday afternoon in the Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, NYPD officers shot and killed 34-year-old Saheed Vassil. Police say they responded to several 911 calls of a man brandishing a gun and found a man taking, quote, a two-handed shooting stance and pointing an object at the police. Four officers fired 10 bullets at Saheed Vassil, who was African-American. It turned out after the confrontation that Mr. Vassil was holding a metal pipe with a knob attached to it. Residents say Saheed Vassil was known in the neighborhood to be mentally ill, but harmless. The reaction in Crown Heights was tense.
It's unfair, totally unfair to the community, totally unfair to our race.
He always help you with it, going to your apartment or going anywhere. And don't bother nobody at all. That guy don't bother nobody. He's a very nice guy.
I'm afraid of my life. Anytime I see them, I get nervous. I'm driving down the street and I see them behind me. I'm scared because all they see is black.
Residents in Crown Heights, that sound brought to us courtesy of WNYC News there. Corey Provost is a community leader in Brooklyn and the district leader for New York's 58th Assembly District, which includes Crown Heights.
So I live on the border of Crown Heights. I heard the gunshots go off live yesterday afternoon.
Corey Provost eventually headed out to the scene of the shooting where he says he spent the night learning more about what happened.
It was very murky, you know, trying to sort the details of what happened, what didn't happen in the early stages of once I got onto the ground. A lot of individuals on the ground that said that he was unarmed. I didn't get, you know, from the officers I spoke to anyone else, no one mentioned that he had a gun. It wasn't until I think the police did their initial press conference that they had mentioned that he had something that looked like a gun. And, you know, this is the narrative that I just find the most troubling is it's always something that looks like a gun. Oftentimes not them actually having a gun.
What are people in the community saying now, a day later?
They are upset. You know, I believe there's going to be a large gathering this evening. There is a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of fear. You know, everyone in the community feels that they could be next because it's always, again, something that looks like a gun. And then the reaction tends to be just, you know, just the overuse of force in situations like this.
How would you characterize, Corey, overall relations between the NYPD and the residents of Crown Heights in Brooklyn?
it's not that individuals don't like the cops. People understand their presence is necessary. We understand that we have to have, you know, open dialogue. And that's something that I always try and play a role in, making sure that those communication lines are open. Unfortunately, what I think is the main issue is usually we deal with the community affairs officers. And I think the NYPD has to step up and get more of the officers that are doing regular patrols to engage the community in more positive ways. And I think that will help broaden or strengthen the relationship.
What are people saying about Saheed Vassil in the days since his death, who he was and how he was known in the community?
Very, very sad. You know, everyone just says that, you know, he's a guy that everyone knows, that he's a guy that the police knew. They knew him to be nonviolent. They knew him to be just someone that's out and about in the community, very well respected, well held in very high regard as someone that's just, you know, the guy that's around the corner, that's, you know, hanging out, that's they're not causing any trouble or doing any harm. So to see this happen, I think caught so many people by surprise.
For people around the country who might not know, Corey, are there any body cameras or other video footage routinely taken when NYPD officers are confronting situations like this on the streets of New York?
So my understanding is that the officers that responded were not wearing body cameras. So I think we obviously have to just speed up the process in getting the officers wearing body cameras, because that could help definitely highlight what happens in these interactions. Now, I know they did receive video footage from some of the commercial businesses that I don't believe they've released that their footage. I saw a couple still images, but you know, I feel that if the still images corroborate their side of events of what happened, the entire video should probably do so. So I encourage the NYPD to, you know, just release the video footage in its full detail so people can get a real sense of what happened.
Corey Provost is a district leader in Crown Heights in Brooklyn and New York City. Corey Provost, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to Kansas now, where a jury is hearing the case against three men accused of plotting to bomb members of a Somali refugee community in Garden City, Kansas. Federal prosecutors say Patrick Stein, Curtis Allen, and Gavin Wright conspired to terrorize Somalis living in an apartment complex in Garden City. They were arrested in October 2016, but the defense now has taken an unusual turn. Claims from the defense that their clients were targeted because the FBI is biased against conservatives. This is one of President Trump's favorite accusations in the Russia investigation. The trial is now in its third week. Ryan Riley is senior justice reporter for HuffPost and for a time has been the only reporter in the trial courtroom this week. He joins me now from Wichita, Kansas. Ryan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Ryan, we learned a few weeks ago that at a relatively early stage, this plot to bomb apartment buildings where Somali refugees lived was basically stage managed by the FBI, by informants and undercover operatives at a pretty early stage. What did we learn from testimony this week?
Sure. So essentially, we learned from Dan Day, who is the FBI informant sort of working on this case, that he was sort of scared by a lot of the language that the other people in the group were sort of using. And he was approached by the FBI pretty early on about becoming sort of an informant for them and letting them know what was happening with this group of militia members. There were a number of militia members earlier on who sort of said they weren't about this more sort of extreme plot and these specific plans to target a Muslim community. They sort of, you know, got away from it and said that they wanted to take more of a defensive posture and would only, you know, take action if they were proactively attacked in some way. But there was this core group here, the three that are now on trial, that did go along with the plan and sort of brought it down the way. There's one sort of ringleader, Patrick Stein, who seems to be the primary, you know, driver of this and the person who would eventually meet with an undercover FBI agent who was posing as someone who could provide the group with some weapons.
And what are prosecutors saying about how much of the motivation for this plan came from the three accused and how much of it came from undercover government operatives?
We know there are some rules that the FBI informant had to follow, as well as, of course, the undercover FBI agent about how much they could actually push forward. The ideas were really supposed to come from the group. This is something that's come up a lot, actually, in cases involving ISIS or cases, perhaps involving al-Qaeda supporters. But typically, you don't really see this type of investigation aimed at, frankly, white defendants or, frankly, non-Muslim defendants. So there's a lot of issues that are going to be raised here and might have more sway with the jury than they would in what, the more typical terrorism case that we see, which is against perhaps someone who is of a Muslim faith.
Now, Ryan, you wrote something interesting in the last couple of days. You wrote that President Trump's attacks on the FBI, which are common on his Twitter feed and even sometimes into microphones, are playing a prominent role in this case. What did you mean?
So essentially, during jury selection, we heard a lot of views sort of echoed by potential members of the jury who were going through this jury selection process, where they would say that, they didn't have a lot of faith in the leadership of the FBI. Now, a lot of them sort of made the distinction that you've recently seen a lot of Fox News commentators and perhaps the president, that, there's a difference between the leadership of the FBI and the agents in the field. And, most of those who even expressed skepticism of the FBI said that they would be able to believe an FBI agent in the field, that's going to be brought up in this case. But it's something that prosecutors don't typically have to deal with, because there's a situation here where the president has basically undermined a lot of the credibility that the FBI has, and has been saying that, the FBI is biased against conservatives, and this was sort of a plot from the beginning against his presidency. And that sort of lines up with a defense that the defendants are making in this case, that, this was a situation where the FBI was unlawfully targeting them and sort of was determined to get them from the beginning because of their conservative beliefs.
Now, it's certainly not uncommon for defendants to put a police department or law enforcement in general on trial, but you say in some ways the shoe's kind of on the other foot here.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, healthy skepticism of the FBI is a good thing. I think that the issue here is that a lot of it's not so much based in. I think the issue really here is that we're seeing that these attacks are really having a trickle-down effect on FBI agents in the field, and a situation here where there's a significant portion of the population that now believes that the FBI has this liberal bias, which, from talking to former FBI agents is sort of really not the situation. The FBI is generally known as a more conservative-leaning organization, and of course, FBI agents would say that, their decisions are not based in politics, but based on, the facts in the field. But the situation we have here now is that a lot of these potential jurors were of this belief that the FBI was basically out to get Trump and out to get perhaps his supporters.
Ryan, do you expect any of these three co-defendants to testify in their own defense? And how much longer is this trial expected to go?
Frankly, I think it's probably pretty unlikely that any of the defendants would testify, just because that would expose them, of course, to a lot of questions from the prosecution. And they would be forced to confront a lot of these, anti-Muslim sort of violent statements that, we know they made because they recorded and they admitted to. What their defense attorneys are going to argue is that this was all a lot of bluster. And specifically, one of the defense attorneys raised the issue or suggested that this was just a lot of locker room talk, sort of echoing a statement that the president made when he had to defend himself, of course, from the Access Hollywood tape. This trial is now in its third week. It's expected to last about six, but right now we're probably going to start seeing a shift to the defense attorney's case in the coming week.
And how is that defense, Ryan, playing that this was all bluster and locker room talk amongst these men to harm Somalis in the community, and that it's also a product of bias against conservatives at the FBI? What do the people in Garden City and the surrounding community have to say about that?
What's really interesting in this case is, first of all, that we're 3.5 hours away from the location of the actual events that we're talking about. And secondly, that the voice of really, frankly, Muslims has been kind of eliminated from this trial. The judge has ruled that the government can't put any potential victims on the stand because of the fact that they only really know about this plot because the government told them about it. Similarly, the sole sort of African-American potential jury in the final jury panel was eliminated because her parents were refugees. So I think what we're going to see coming forward is that the defense is going to suggest that this was just all a lot of bluster and it didn't really amount to much. But that's going to be sort of tough for them to make that case, given how many you know, sort of extreme anti-Muslim and violent statements we have from the defendants.
Ryan Riley reporting from Wichita, Kansas. Ryan, thanks so much.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Ryan Riley is senior justice reporter for HuffPost. Fifty years ago this week, in the hours after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, violence broke out in 130 cities across America. But in the middle of all that chaos and rioting, there was an oasis of relative peace in Boston. And a lot of people attribute that calm to one man who wasn't exactly known for quieting people down. The night after Dr. King's murder, 50 years ago tonight, James Brown, the godfather of soul, performed a concert in Boston. It was broadcast live on television by WGBH, our partner station. Bob C. of WGBH was a graduate student working in the TV control room on the night of that concert, and he remembers how it all played out.
As a graduate student working at WGBH, I found myself in the control room the night of April 5, 1968, watching the now legendary James Brown concert unfold. But at the time, none of us knew it would be historic. In fact, we weren't sure that there would be a concert at all. The day after King's death, word began circulating at the station about a live broadcast we might be doing that night from the Boston Garden, starring the most popular and influential black performer of the time. The concert had been scheduled months before, but fearful of anything that would provoke the kind of protest and violence rocking other American cities, Boston's new mayor, Kevin White, initially wanted to cancel the show. Author James Sullivan said it was local DJ Jimmy Bird who changed the mayor's mind.
Jimmy Bird said, "You can't cancel the James Brown show because if you do that, you're going to have 14,000 kids showing up at the Boston Garden, finding out by a piece of paper stuck on the door that the show has been canceled. And, you know, if they're not already angry and distraught over the murder of Dr. King, now they're really going to be mad."
But there was still concern about thousands of teenagers roaming the streets of Boston after the show. Someone in the mayor's office thought if the concert could be broadcast on TV, then people could watch it from the safety of their homes. And the station that was asked to do it, when others declined, was WGBH. But station executives wondered if it could be pulled off considering the technical challenges of broadcasting live from Boston Garden. Or worse, they could end up airing a riot instead of a concert. Finally, those in favor prevailed. But Sullivan says when Brown found out that people were being told to stay home, he wasn't happy.
If you put the show on TV for free, who's going to come? So he said, "I'll do it if the city government can promise me some money," which they did. Whether or not it was paid in full is another story. But he said, "Okay, I'll do it." And at that point, he recognized what kind of cultural impact that gesture could have.
Regardless of the uncertainty, the crew at WGBH had begun preparing earlier in the day. I remember helping to put together the equipment we would need to do the broadcast. But the final decision to go ahead wasn't made until just 3 hours before the concert was to begin. Director David Atwood said he was so pressed for time, it never occurred to him they might be in any danger should violence break out.
"We had an awareness of why we were there, that's for darn sure. But we were really focused on just bringing it off, you know. We were using other people's cables, we were in the garden at the last minute. You know, we didn't really know what was coming at us, although we knew it was James Brown, you know, it was like, whoa."
And so the show went on with only a 45-minute delay. Brown began by praising the mayor and Tom Atkins, the only black member of the Boston City Council.
"Boston is paying, the city is paying for this. It's very nice. You have Mr. Tom Atkins and the Honorable Mayor White to be thankful for doing this, because they made the decision. They're spending a lot of money for the city, I'll tell you that. So give them another big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen."
And when Boston Mayor Kevin White took the stage right afterwards, he appealed for calm.
"So let us look at each other, here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace."
But at one point, it appeared things might spiral out of control. As a local newspaper photographer, Richard Chase recalls.
The people that were there, especially the young people, loved him. They jumped on the stage, and the police did not like that. They, I'll tell you, they were ready. Actually, a couple of them pulled out their clubs, and James, you know, he said, "I'll handle it." He took over.
Wait, wait, this is no way. We are black. Let y'all go back down and let's do the show together. We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show. Come off the stage. Step down there. Be a gentleman. You make me look very bad because I asked the police to step back and you wouldn't go down. No, that's wrong.
That night, James Brown managed to do what few other performers could do. He took control and kept the peace. In the end, the big gamble appeared to have paid off. The city was unusually quiet. Brown himself walked the streets of Roxbury to see if his show had the desired effect. And WGBH jazz DJ Al Davis, who attended the concert as a teenager, remembers the scene heading home.
Well, I thought there was going to be some problems. The trains weren't going to be on time. There was going to be huge crowds, people angry. But everybody was just nice to each other, you know, and sat down on the train like a Sunday afternoon. Unbelievable.
The concert was being recorded, so it could be rebroadcast throughout the night. Those who were there say the James Brown concert 50 years ago was unlike any event that happened before or could happen again, when the power of a single performer broadcast to an entire city brought such healing and peace in a time of such grief and turmoil. For The Takeaway, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
That piece comes to us from our partner station WGBH in Boston. Well, that's just about all for us today. But earlier in the show, we heard about how sea level rise and salt are making it harder for farmers on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Well, it might not be too much comfort to those farmers in the eastern shore and across America, but there is some exciting news this week. Out of Antarctica, scientists announced a harvest of salad greens, cucumbers, and radishes, all grown in Antarctica, without soil, without pesticides, even without daylight. This is all part of a plan to test whether future space travelers can grow fresh produce on other planets. Space kale, is it in your future? Who knows? Whole Foods on Mars? This is all part of the plan, the testing going on in Antarctica. Anyway, we always want to hear from you. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Join our conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 8778-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.